It is Saturday, February 19th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, an entire hour of geek news. That's right. We got the geeks in the house, and we'll be chatting about the geek news of the week.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be covering the week in geek news with a full cohort of geeks. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. As long as you give us credit and also share your work, you're welcome to use our work in anything you do. Please feel free to do so. Just link us to us at geekspeak.org. And the theme song today was by Michael Newman of PetStar Music. Thank you, Michael, for providing that theme song. We, of course, are always looking for theme song ideas and music. If you'd like to record something and send it our way, we'd be happy to give it a shot. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Al Luckow, a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hi, everybody.
We have Alex Leas, an application security analyst.
Good morning, Lyle.
It's nice to have you in the flesh every once in a while. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's fun to be here.
And you're sitting directly across from me, so I'll be paying attention to you the entire
show. I'll stare right at you the whole time.
don't forget to read as well. And we have Lindsay Lani, assistant analyst. Hi. Oh, you know what? You must be on five.
I must be on five.
You are.
Good morning.
That microphone is very intense looking.
Isn't it?
You look like a child.
I have the most impressive microphone of all.
Well, in any case, let's go ahead and start with the geek news. I'm totally intrigued by new car technology, Al. So I'm going to start with you. And you're talking about a car that's like a Lego,
yeah.
Almost.
Yeah. The GM has this prototype car. It's called the Hi-Wire. And Hi is referring to hydrogen, and wire is referring to driving by a wire system. Basically, there are no linkages. There's no hydraulics. There's really no pedals or anything.
It doesn't sound like a very good car at all.
It just goes. Well, it's a prototype car, and they have it, you know, running. I've seen videos of it. They're going to be linked after the show. And it's a very cool car. Basically, if you can imagine like a rectangle that's 11 inches thick with four wheels on it, okay? Everything that makes the car go.
So it's about a foot high, and it's got wheels on it.
Yes.
And that's
it's kind of like in Space Odyssey, that thing floating in space.
Right.
That thing with wheels.
What was that called?
The monolith or
monolith,
something
you.
Like that. Okay. Anyway, so it's like that thing. And it's just this box. And inside there, it has the hydrogen fuel cells, all the things that it needs to create the energy to make the car go. As a matter of fact, it creates enough energy to power your entire house. But let's not get into that right now because we're talking about cars.
All right.
So this thing starts to drive. Now, the top of the car, it looks like it can be any, looks like anything, like any kind of car.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they made it all futuristic looking and, you know, smooth and Jetson-y, but could be anything. So they drop that on there and you have seats. You sit in the driver's seat and there are no pedals or anything. So your feet are just kind of like sitting on the floor like you're sitting at a chair or
anything.
They
don't provide an ottoman?
There's nothing there. There is a steering wheel, but it's really one of those kind of handlebar things where it looks like there's
Tron.
Two grips. Yeah. Yeah, it's like a Tron thing. There's grips on both sides. And you twist the grip to go to move, and then you squeeze them for braking. And then you steer just like a regular car. And the thing drives around, and it's really amazing. They show the guy, it's on the BBC, the video that I'll have linked. He's like, it's a little hard to get used to, but the steering wheel can move to either side because, you know, in England, they drive on, their cars are built so that the driver's seat is on the wrong side.
Right. Yes. So this one, you could.
So he was able to just slide it over so he could drive
the
wrongly.
Wrong side. So, but there's no, from your description, it's not like, normally in a car, the steering wheel actually has a shaft and it goes into the mm-hmm. engine compartment. And then there's a shifting point where it goes down to the drive chain. And actually, physically, there's a connection from the steering wheel all the way to the wheels.
Right.
And of course, sometimes it has a motor assist, of course, power steering. Mm-hmm. This thing doesn't have that kind of thing.
No,
right?
It's all wired. It's like
you could connect an iPod to it and with an application and then drive it remotely, no problem. Right?
Probably, okay. Yeah.
So
there's a lot of planes that operate this way, like fighter planes.
Drive by wire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would assume that there's like some risk associated with that. Like
well,
you don't want the OS to crash because you then can't.
You don't
drive
want anything
to crash.
The crashing is there's a lot of puns in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
They only have one
I've got
of these.
Four, so.
Yeah.
Four.
They only have one, but it hasn't crashed yet.
Uh-huh.
But the cool thing about it is this chassis, since it's just a universal kind of chassis, you can drop any kind of top you want in there. So say you have, you know, this fancy sports car and you're driving around saying, hey, you know what? I want to drive down to, you know, L.A. for the weekend. Or from here, it's like a six-hour drive.
I want a van.
Yeah, I want a van. Yeah. So you just go to the station. It swaps out your top. It takes about 30 minutes. They actually show it happening in the video. And then just a little thing comes down, unhooks the top part, unclicks it, and then drops a new top on top of it.
That's
and it's
awesome.
Like a whole different car.
Just that's awesome.
Immediately.
I mean, this is what reminds me of Lego, because I can imagine like,
right.
you know, a two block high block of with wheels on it, and
right.
then you just put different tops on the top of it.
Yeah, because Lego does have, actually, Lego already did this, because they do have the little black.
I think it's a hard marketing sell.
And
drive
this,
a toy.
This car, you know, they're talking about, well, it's probably like, maybe never going to drive this car specifically,
right.
but within 20 years, these are the kind of cars we're going to be in. And if you want to look at something that's maybe a little closer and a little realer.
For hydrogen?
Yeah. As far as hydrogen goes, Toyota just announced that they will be selling hybrid hydrogen vehicles by 2015. Toyota.
That's pretty soon.
Yep. And it's a battery only. And they're talking about battery only autos by 2012.
I thought that hydrogen was the power source of the future, and it always will be.
It is not a power source. It is a power sink. It's a storage mechanism.
But you didn't get my joke. The joke was funny still. Let me see if I can rephrase it. Damn geeks ruining jokes.
Well, we're, you know, we
the,
are.
Hydrogen is the power medium of the future, and it always will be, in the sense that people have been talking about hydrogen as this way of moving energy around for a long time. We never see it actually work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have.
Except on the coast of Norway.
What? Why the coast of Norway?
They have a highway there that has hydrogen fueling stations all along the coast.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, there's one last thing I want to mention about these alternative electronic
sure.
hydrogen vehicles. They attract rats. Okay, next story.
Let's do this. We're currently in an IRC chat. You're welcome to join us. You can also send us email, and we'll periodically look at that. Let's see if you can figure out, you're listening live to GeekSpeak, go ahead and see if you can figure out why electric cars might attract rats, okay? We'll leave it at that. We'll cover the story a little bit later in the show. Alex, tell us about mistakes made by the U.S. government. Wait. Let's be a little closer. Tell us about network mistakes by the U.S. government, would you?
There's a lot. That's a big open can of worms there. Recently, the U.S. government had accidentally shut down 84,000 websites.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Homeland
Security's,
walking along the street, trip, fall, land on 84,000 websites. It can happen.
Apparently. ICE had gone after a handful.
What's ICE?
ICE is, what it stood for.
Solid water, or is it something else?
No. Homeland Security's ICE.
Immigration
division.
And Customs Enforcement.
There you go.
Ooh, somebody can do a Wikipedia search. Sorry. Go on.
It was actually not a Wikipedia search.
Oh, okay. It's just that cool.
Oh, please. Miles is Mr. Acronym. Anyway, they had gone after a few sites that were apparently involved in child pornography and stuff related to that. Well, during their process, they went and got the warrants to shut down the sites, and a mistake was made somewhere in this process, and they ended up shutting down freedns.org.
Oh.
And every site that FreeDNS was pretty much supporting.
You know what? Ben's site
is FreeDNS.
So it's so quite possible that Ben's site
was
FreeDNS. First off, let's describe what DNS is. Miles, DNS stands for?
Domain Name System.
Very good, Mima. And that's Miles is Mr. Acronym, Mima. That's your new name. So
I'm all about the TLAs.
That's right, three-letter acronym.
Although sometimes that can be a PITA.
LOL.
I can't keep up. Stop, stop. No, don't do that. Okay, so DNS is the system in the internet that takes a domain name like geekspeak.org and translates it to a number which reference where that machine is, an IP number. The internet phone book. So one of these services called FreeDNS, which provides that that for free. Normally, it's about a $9 a month or $9 a year kind of thing. So you use FreeDNS, and it's hosting your domain name service, which means that you can then point your machine anywhere you want. And it's kind of a cool service. Normally, you have to get a service provider to do this kind of thing for you. Though I think we host our own DNS server on geekspeak.org. So the federal government was trying to figure out these porn issues and, or specifically, illegal things like child mm-hmm. pornography.
Yep.
They decided to close down a whole bunch of sites by basically removing the IP address or blocking the IP address. How'd they do it?
They actually took the sites and redirected them to a page or effectively an image. And let me read what all of these websites had as their homepage.
Okay, well, first off, so what happened is they mistakenly happened to grab a whole DNS server, which is...
Well, a provider.
A provider.
I mean,
they basically told someone like... AT&T, hey, AT&T machine, stop giving information out, and instead, everybody that goes to go there, go here instead.
Exactly. And
that's bad.
What they ended up having was, you know, the big logo for Department of Justice and all that, and it says, this domain name has been seized by ICE, Homeland Security Investigations, pursuant to a seizure warrant issued by a U.S. Warrant District, blah, 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 blah. Advertisement, distribution, transportation, receipt, and possession of child pornography constitute federal crimes that carry penalties of first-time offenders of up to 30 years in federal prison, mm-hmm. a $250,000 fine and forfeiture and restitution. So all these websites had this message on them.
It seems like a pretty appropriate thing for a federal government to do if a site is actually providing child pornography.
If it was, but 84,000 sites that, you know, where maybe 83,990 of them did not have this and had this on their site. As you can imagine, a lot of people are really mad.
I still want the story of like the website that's for like the local child services group, right? Or a children's center kind of place where you take your kids and all of a sudden their site says this. You're like,
I was actually thinking of
the PTA's.
I was actually thinking of bringing this down to earth. Imagine you went to the phone book. You needed to find a plumber. And the U.S. government had gone to the AT&T phone book and turned all of the plumber numbers
to one number.
All go to the same switchboard
said
this business has been shut down due to child pornography issues.
That wouldn't damage your reputation
This is directly correlative.
How long were the sites, how long was this effective?
I didn't see an actual timeline. It was apparently fairly short. I'm not sure if it was hours or a day.
From a mathematical perspective, though, 84,000 websites compared to how many websites there are is, I think, almost statistically nothing. So
you're one of those 84,000 websites.
Well, thank you.
I mean, and the thing is, when they went and made a statement about their efforts, they patted themselves on the back for the websites they got, and they completely did not mention that this had happened.
Of course not. And the other thing is, that one happened clearly because of a mistake. Like, that was a clear mistake. But it's very... of course, 84,000 people or websites got affected, and therefore the mistake was caught and fixed. But what about the guy that doesn't have child pornography, happened to have a mistake, and now the website doesn't work anymore? And, you know, probably the process is really complicated to get it working again. If there's, you know... Yeah. And then the other thing about that is that lots of times illegal content on the internet, illegal content, questionable content, child pornography, of course, illegal stuff, but also copyrighted material is actually put up on websites without the owner of the website knowing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a mm-hmm. hack or something. And all of us have experienced, you know, having old WordPress install and somebody mm-hmm. hacking it and then putting spam on there.
I had to clean out a website just 2 months ago from a one that was built, and the woman's like, I'm blacklisted. I don't know what's wrong. And I go and I look, and it's like completely loaded with all sorts of like
spam.
Just like a gigabyte of stuff. And I'm like, did you give anybody else your FTP info? Because I'm about ready to just wipe the whole thing.
Right. And her name's Jan, and her password is Jan.
password.
Yeah, right. It was like, and that's so as simple that, as that was a real, you know, man.
So that's the thing about a system like this where you decide to, you know, universally turn something off so drastically. If you don't have the form, the structure in place to repair the problems, you get things like that. Like, that's not really the way to handle it. If I had a store, if I had a storefront, and somebody went and put something inappropriate in my storefront, and the federal government sees that and then changes my my phone, the phone book, to point that, say, my business is doing, you know, child pornography, that's kind of a complicated process in how then you fix it. And yeah, if they're making mistakes like 84,000 people that had nothing to do with child pornography at all, that's not good.
Yeah, I mean, if they had, I mean, if they issue a warrant, aren't you supposed to be served the warrant?
Well, that is, yes.
And how did they end up? I mean, I guess, again, it's a mistake. So somehow, but none of these people had any idea. There's no phone number on the website that was given that they were directed to. They have no idea how to follow up.
Did it just say ICE, or did it actually have the acronym spelled out in the image?
No, it actually, I think it actually said, no, it's just seizure by ICE Homeland Security Investigations.
Great. I love that they put an acronym on there. Thousands of websites go down and you go, what's ICE?
I think a lot of people know what ICE is nowadays.
Well, I didn't.
No. you live in a little bubble, dude.
And also because you're white.
What? Thanks for bringing the race in there, Miles. I appreciate that. Lindsay, let's get more serious and talk about healthcare.
Okay. Let's talk about sharks in healthcare.
Excellent.
Particularly sharks in the emergency room. So sharks are amazing creatures. You know, I think most people will agree.
As long as they don't gain the ability to fly or travel on land, I love those things.
So then this story is going to mess it up.
Yeah. Or learn how to manufacture lasers.
Yes.
That would be bad. Well, you know, they don't get cancer. I don't even know what kills them besides, like, misfortune
or age. They do get cancer.
They do get cancer, yeah. It's an urban legend.
Yeah. I love those urban legends.
Yeah, okay. Love them. They're so persistent.
Yeah. So there are several species of shark that violate a general rule of the marine environment. So the rule is, if you move slowly, most of the time, organisms like algae and barnacles will attach to your surface. So think of, like, whales, turtles, manatees, things like that. And if you move quickly, most of the time, you won't have things attaching to your skin. You'll stay smooth. Orcas, dolphins, tuna, things like that. So it's most likely like an energy equation at work. So it takes too much energy for the attaching organism to attach to and stay on the fast movers.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
The interesting thing, though, is that many species of shark actually violate that. They move slowly, but their skin stays clean and smooth.
Hmm.
So a lot of research was being done on the chemistry of shark skin, trying to figure out why they were the exception to this rule. And it was eventually discovered that it wasn't the composition of the skin, it was the texture. They have denticles, which are like scales, that come together in a unique pattern. It's likely to have evolved for that specific purpose of keeping them clean. And so the texture pattern has been the inspiration for a product that's now being made by a company called Sharklet Technologies. I think that's such a cool name.
And they're selling denticles?
Yeah, exactly. They're making a thin plastic film that can be attached to a variety of surfaces to make them inhospitable to bacteria.
Ooh.
Yeah. So imagine...
Hence the emergency room part of the story.
Exactly. It's all coming together now.
Yeah.
So imagine like an environmentally friendly, non-chemical antibacterial surface. So
nice.
You're also not contributing to bacterial resistance by using antibiotics and stuff like that if you use something
of course
like this.
What you're talking about is in a sterile environment, you're constantly killing everything possible, and therefore whatever grows well.
Exactly.
So are you, does this have the same texture as shark skin?
Right. Can you rub it both directions and you cut your hands?
Right.
Yeah.
So the texture is so, so tiny. They're like three micrometers tall or something.
Microns tall.
Microns tall. Uh-huh. Thank you. So it's like 1/10 of a human hair.
Right.
Tall.
So the texture is not noticeable.
Right. Exactly. And they can make it super thin.
So just the shape of the texture causes microbes not to be able to grow onto it.
Exactly. It's the equivalent. they compare it to the equivalent of like Mount Everest for bacteria.
Okay. So I'll get an analogy. It's kind of like those pointy things they put on top of stuff so birds don't land on them, right?
Exactly.
It's like that for
it's
bacteria.
It's like that for bacteria.
Cool.
Exactly. So it's just too much work for them to attach to it. So right now they're in trials in hospitals and places like that with bed rails, bed rail control panels, nursing call buttons, monitor covers, push door plate covers, places where people are touching a lot.
Right.
And in the future, I mean, can you imagine like
how about
ATM?
Like gloves? That'd be cool.
Everyone wears shark skin gloves.
Oh, ATMs too.
Great. Can you imagine, like, ATMs, toilet handles? Like, what about money?
Spread so well. So does it only work with bacteria, though, or virus is still going to go, hey, cool, Everest?
Stuff like E. coli, anything like that, it works.
The bigger stuff, yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Great. I did not know what the story was when you had the title of sharks in the emergency room, but it scared me. And now yeah. I'm not scared. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In just a minute, we're going to be finding out why rats like electric cars, and no one's told us yet, so we're going to have to tell you. But first, Miles, what's the cheapest networks around?
You'd have to ask ants.
I don't speak ant.
Well, then you won't find out then, will you?
Ant actually is a language. Ant is
oh, I do speak a little ant. I do use a little ant.
It's usually used in healthcare applications. It's like Bluetooth, kind of.
Well, it's a Unix. What does ant stand for?
Isn't it for Java?
It's some
it's
kind
a
of
Java build tool as well.
Yeah. So you may speak ant.
I don't yet.
No, I don't speak ant.
Nobody here speaks ant?
No one wants to learn.
Okay.
Speak.
Well,
people are trying to
carry on then.
Unlearn
just
ant.
Trying to be correct about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But it turns out one of the things with networks is you want to have the shortest interconnect points in between two arbitrary points on the outside. So if you have 10 nodes, you want to have the shortest number of bridge points or routing points possible.
We're talking about all these stories. Totally makes sense. Go to Miles, routing points, bridge nodes. What?
Well, imagine...
You're going to have to describe a little bit how a network works. Let's use the metaphor of this room, right? So okay. If I'm on a network, I can maybe only communicate with Lindsay, and then Lindsay can communicate with Alex. So by using Lindsay, I can
communicate with Alex. On the contrary, that's a point-to-point.
That's a point-to-point
point
node.
That is not the most efficient type of network.
So another network would be that I connect to... Everybody connects to everybody, and we can speak to each other.
Right. In other words, you wouldn't want to have a road going from every house to every other house. You would want to have a road. You would want to have houses connected to a common road that
right.
connect up to other common roads, so that you get the shortest distance. This is common for city planning as well.
So, in that scenario, if a network in this room would be me as a central point, and all of you speak only to me, and then or you speak. Does that kind of work? It
then you become a bottleneck.
Yeah, I mean,
this room is a bad metaphor
the board,
because we're basically a broadcast network. We're just putting it all in the room, and if we were all talking, it'd be noise. And that's actually
it's
the way broadcasts
of the show anyway.
Right, and within computer science and within mathematics, there's a thing called a Steiner tree, and that maps this problem. As it turns out, ants are excellent at finding the shortest possible networking path
over my kitchen counter.
Over our kitchen counters. So
they're network engineers, what you're saying.
It has here that super colonies of Argentinian ants with 500, 1,000, or 2,000 workers are self-organizing into these Steiner trees. Hmm. So actually
and
what
so,
they're...
So this is a mathematical term you use in computer science, the Steiner tree, and it's complicated.
In mathematics, but
it's a complicated thing, and you've got to figure out and design your system to use it effectively. And what you're saying is ants just do it.
Yes. They do it organically, so... And I'm sure there's a whole lot of trial and error, but they are... What happens is you have researchers looking at how ants do it so that they can discover how we might be able to make better mesh networks, for
right.
example, wireless mesh networks.
When you're saying ants do it, not reproduction, but ants traveling. So when you talk about this network, it's you've got a source of where the ants live, and you've got all
right.
these different
when
food
they drop, like,
and as
know,
they start
their chemical
finding the path,
yeah.
they actually produce networks that are extremely efficient.
Yes, that are optimally efficient.
Optimally efficient. So they have like a freeway area, and the freeway can have multiple branches off to different sources, and they're all traveling that way.
Yeah, it gets more complex than that, but
it's really cool.
Basically.
And when you talk about a mesh network, you're talking about independent network nodes figuring out how to communicate. Kind of on the fly. So you build
a pretty
smart node, and then you drop it anywhere, and it starts to work efficiently.
The idea is if you had 1,000 people that you wouldn't need a central ISP per se. The idea is that you'd be hopping through each other's computers mm-hmm. to get there. And then what is the shortest path so that any arbitrary person with a computer that has a mesh node can talk to another
right.
mesh node?
And to produce that very efficient path without having some smart system overseeing it. It's not like the queen of the ant hive says, hey, Frank, today you're going this way.
Right. Because
they all
be
just
point
figured
point.
Out. Yeah, right. Yeah, and they all figured out on their own.
Star pattern,
very cool. All right. Well, speaking of ant languages, Al, you got a language story for us?
Oh, yeah. Actually, this is a study that was actually announced at a conference by a professor. And the professor's name was I always get the hardest ones. Ellen Bielstock. And she's a psychology professor at York University in Toronto. And she was presenting at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And what she discovered was about Alzheimer's symptoms. It turns out that being bilingual can actually delay getting Alzheimer's.
Cool.
What she's found, in the way that the study went, which, I mean, from our standpoint, it's finally a good reason to learn Klingon.
Klingon, of course.
So the thing is, she took 450 Alzheimer's patients, all of whom were at the same degree of impairment at the time of the diagnosis. Half of them were bilingual for regularly or for most of their lives. And they found that the onset of the worst Alzheimer's symptoms was delayed by 4 or 5 years for all the people who were bilingual.
Cool. So 4 or 5 years if you know another language.
Yeah.
So does knowing computer languages work?
I don't know. Nope. You know what? They didn't
have to be able to speak it. Huh?
The thing about it is what they said was when you learn a language, your brain learns to turn off a full section. Like when you're speaking two different languages, you can turn off your whole other language in your head. You learn how to do this. And so that ability to turn the whole part
this
of it
this
off
is the assumption.
On.
They're not sure about this.
Yeah, this,
no,
is the assumption.
This is actually common with language learning. It's called your second voice. People refer to it when you're talking that you stop being the same person you are speaking English. You become a different persona, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And then the state of being able to dream another language is like another level of that, where you actually have a subconscious in a second language as well. So, but the idea being that they theorize the reason why this Alzheimer is delayed in someone like this is that they can turn off their brain and re-enable it.
Yeah,
in some ways, and that it actually be effective.
When a lot of the conclusions point back to the use it or lose it idea. When they say, well, these people should be doing crossword puzzles and keeping their brain active.
And that supposedly helps
the bilingual part. I mean, does it matter if you learned it when you were young or you're old? In their study, these people learned it when they were young. Okay, it's much more difficult to learn a language after puberty.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't do it, anyway.
So Ben can still learn languages.
Yes.
It's not fun to tease him.
Yeah, we tease him. Yeah. Yeah. If he's here, we can tease him.
Use your brain.
Yeah. I actually talked about this topic with Dr. Dawn at one point, and she was saying, yeah, it makes sense. You have more connections going on, and so if some connections die off, you still have the alternate.
How's your Spanish, Miles?
Más o menos. No practico mucho.
I have an iPhone app for that, so... I mean, I wonder if we're using less of
your iPhone app when you're losing your brain.
I'm thinking that doesn't help.
Are we losing our ability to think by having all these convenient devices thinking for us now?
What were you saying?
I don't know.
Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by the Athos of Santa Cruz and Monterey Counties, hosting monthly meetings. Details at 831-216-6112, facebook.com/friendlyfreethinkers, or online search term Santa Cruz Atheists Meetup. Atheists of Santa Cruz and Monterey Counties, a secular community group. Today on GeekSpeak, we have Lindsay Lonnie, Alex Slias, Miles Elam, and Al Luckow. And Al, you've got a geek bit of the week today?
Sure. There's a pretty cool iPhone app. It's called IntoNow, and it's free. And what it does, it's very similar to SoundHound or Shazam, which basically when you're in an area and you hear music and you just turn this iPhone app on, it'll listen for a few seconds because there's a digital signature to all music, and then it'll tell you who is singing and all that kind of stuff. Well, this new app called IntoNow does the same thing for TV. So if you kind of walk in, you're like, what the heck is on? You just turn this app on, you hold it up, and it'll tell you what show is playing and what the episode is and the synopsis and everything, just by listening from a few seconds.
How large is their database?
They're saying that they guarantee any shows that that have been around for like 5 years will have this digital signature. Even there's a lot that have it. They have it. Their database is growing, but they go back.
How much audio do they say they need?
Well, there's a demo of it, which I'll have posted, and it looks like it does it in about 20 seconds.
I'd love to just do the laugh tracks of shows and see how many times that laugh track is used.
Oh, yeah, the same laugh track.
Yeah.
The same.
But if it's 20 seconds, you probably need more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that would be, it's pretty, we're getting to that point where you can just, it's almost like a tricorder. Just whenever
That's an interesting thing because, of course, for this company to do this, they had to record all television, get the audio files of it, and then index that computer to them, meaning basically make a lookup of it. Well, now, they don't actually have to store what the audio is. They only have to store the, quote, fingerprint of the audio.
Right.
So theoretically, they're not maybe infringing in the copyright of the original broadcaster. But that database existence, that that idea is already kind of in that space of, is it valid for them to have that data? Because it's technically a representation of television shows they don't own. Well, so it's a really interesting
I think the data
problem.
Going back 5 years is already available. It's already digitally
sure.
stamped.
No, it's available, but producing their database structure of it, their index of the audio to make fingerprints is not something they can like grab from Hulu or something. I mean, they've got to get that, they had to have the audio files to generate it.
That's true.
Interesting, though. Yeah. And I'm sure, I mean, maybe they've teamed up with different broadcasters. They're doing it all in the up and up, and maybe they're just hoping that they slide under the wire. But it's a very cool tool. And is it free or is it
free
app? Cool.
It's free. I mean, it's
Do you know if there's an Android version of it?
You know what? I didn't find one. The article I read about it mentioned the but you know, anytime you see this kind of thing on iPhone,
it shows up eventually.
Yeah.
Called Into Now. Thank you for the geek bit. Mm-hmm. This is Geek Speak on KOSP. KOSP is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. And again, in the air room with me, Lindsay Lonnie, Miles Elam, Alex Slias, and Al Luckow. And we're doing geek news today. We're not doing phone calls. We are still curious if you have a theory on why rats like electric cars, other than electric cars are cool, please do call us and let us know. I believe I just handled a great story by Mr. Luckow. And so let's go ahead and jump down to... Oh, you guys have moved the news around.
It's all in order. Just go to it.
Well, then it's you, Alex. So we'll go ahead and go with the RSA.
All right. So this last week, there was a big conference for security up in San Francisco called the RSA Security Conference. It's probably the largest security conference in the world. They have a few of them that are done through the year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the big topics at RSA had to do with the use of cell phones and smartphones and all these devices that we have that are basically little mini computers, and that there is a rising concern of how often or how many of these devices are going to be around, what data they're being used to access. And not only is it a concern of ours in the security world, but it's also a focus for the bad guys.
Why?
Because it is more. It's more. It's more access to devices. It's more access to information. It's more ways for them to create spam bots. It's more ways for them to learn about people, to devise more complicated attacks if they want to.
Okay.
It's information gathering, and as one session that I had gone to discuss, you know, it's basically like building a network of little spies everywhere.
Right.
And they're gathering all this info.
So your basic thing, it's a new resource, if you think of the bad guys as bacteria or something trying to look for places to be.
Yeah,
the cell phone systems and the smartphones are just another place to live and thrive.
One example, a recent example, is for the Android phone. There was an app, I don't recall the name offhand, that actually the malware basically records your voice, records things you say and you talk on the phone, and ships it out to some database for hackers to use.
I thought you were going to say it listens to the TV shows you're listening to and tries to figure out what you're doing. But
yeah, that would be useful to them.
So you're saying is that as we get complicated systems, we have a real threat there. I'm curious about this because, of course, there's different ways of handling this problem, right? And Apple, for example, on their smartphones has been very restrictive on what you can install by default. And I would say it restricts your freedom with your device, but also potentially protects you from these malware apps a little bit better, maybe?
No, I don't think. And I mean, a little bit, but yeah.
I'm assuming that the malware that you're talking about that was on the Android phone wasn't on the Android store. What is it called?
Actually, I think that one was.
It really was.
And
okay.
Even so for Apple, I mean, there's tons of stuff out there that Apple just, there's too much that comes in for them to be able to really review every little thing.
We hear about them rejecting applications for silly reasons, but I'm sure they accept bad applications.
Sure, and a lot of those are the ones that advertise this is what we're doing. You know, but how many flashlight apps are really out there on the Apple Store, and how many of them actually have alternative malware embedded into them, little Trojans?
I tend to believe that it's probably a little bit of a more strict environment, development environment, and they've got some protection as they scan stuff. I'm assuming.
It's not
really.
So basically you're talking about the
horrible malware and virus systems that are in the Windows world are eminent on the smartphones.
Yes. It's hitting the smartphones.
So it sounds like right now, you knowing that and being a security expert, you should start a business on making antivirus for smartphones, right? Doesn't that sound like a good market? Just a fear-based could sell
things. It's already there, yeah. And it's a growing market.
Yeah, but does it do anything?
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It is kind of scary, of course, because my phone not only has all the people I know, my calendar on it, private photographs, of course, audio that maybe is public, maybe is not, but it also knows where I am all the time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the applications have my the applications on the phone have authentication and approval automatically built in for all my social environments. So getting complete control over my phone would basically represent complete control of my digital identity.
Exactly. And there's a lot, I mean, that expands. A lot of people think, well, who cares if they know where I am?
Right.
But there's a lot of, and, you know, if people, you know, the more information that's gathered about people, we may not be able to think of why that's a bad thing now.
Right.
But,
well, I mean, just simple things like it's pretty easy. If you have an environment that doesn't have, like, let's say a community that doesn't have a lot of kids, and you can detect cell phones, you can pretty quickly build a map on, like, how many cell phones live at this house. Mm-hmm. And once that map shows that there's no cell phones there, you know no one's home. I mean, it's simple things like that, yeah, which you could do in mass pretty easily.
People did that with Facebook.
Right.
There was criminals on the East Coast that were actually using Facebook pages that were public to find out when people weren't home, like they were going on vacation posting on it, and they were robbing these houses. And the only reason they caught them was because some cop happened to be in the neighborhood.
See, the trick with that is to say, hey, last month I went to Africa or whatever it is. You talk about it in the rears.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right.
Just one last note on there, yeah, with RSA. Out of all the things that were being discussed, all the different hacker discussions and cases that had gone down, the thing that scared me the most was Michio Kaku's keynote speech, because he was telling us about the next 50 years and how many things are going to be out there, how much information. Things embedded into our bodies, and, you know, it's like I start thinking about that, and I'm sure everybody in that room with a security mind,
yeah,
starts going, oh my God.
Yeah.
That's a lot of data.
I mean, we talk about medical private data and such, and that seems to always kind of be this concern point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as you start really thinking about what kind of data starts becoming available all the time, it's overwhelming. Basically, mm-hmm, anything you can try, anything that happens in the real world slowly becomes a digital file.
But you know, and it's scary and all that, but let me just offer one alternative view, is the more information we have to sift through, the more we know about things. Like, maybe we find out that, hey, these people who all went to the mall, or it tends to be people who go to the mall a lot, have cancer. You know, so then we take a lot of this data that we get, and we're able to make assumptions out of it. I don't think every assumption that comes out of a lot of this data gathering is you know, for bad purposes.
Yeah. No, and I love your optimism in this, that we are going to find new amazing things based off of this data that potentially could be scary. We're also, mm-hmm, going to find real benefit to,
right,
society benefit. Things
it's
like
a two-way street.
You know, traffic, right, becoming better because we figure out ways of managing our, you know, knowledge and, mm-hmm, our movements.
Isn't that what we already do?
Yeah.
I mean, they already know how many cell phones are on the road, and that's how they tell,
definitely,
whether it's busy.
Yeah, that's how Google, yeah, Maps produces the traffic flows. And yes, and benefit's going to come out, but I just want to say that as you collect more and more data, the data level gets so large that it becomes Herculean to try to solve any problems. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's one of the reasons why medicine is such a trial and error and takes so long for us to figure things out, because it's so difficult to really take out all the variables and figure out what the causal effect is. And that gets extremely complicated in complicated systems. And as we have collection everywhere, we're talking about a much more complicated system and a lot more data. But let's move on, shall we? Let's talk about space a little bit, or at least some celestial bodies. So, shall we, Lindsay?
I'm going to go sit under a tree and think about this. So in 1971, a bunch of sycamore seeds circled the moon 34 times in Apollo 14, specifically in astronaut Stuart Roos's pocket.
Oh, cool.
Afterwards, they were all ceremoniously planted all over the country in prestigious locations.
Moon trees.
Exactly.
Why sycamores?
I don't know why sycamores particularly.
But then again, if you said spruce, I would have been like, why spruce?
Right.
Okay, go on.
Maybe he just liked them.
Maybe.
But afterwards, they seemed to be forgotten. Nobody was really keeping records on their growth or what was happening to them. They did a couple of experiments growing them next to sycamores that had not had seeds in space, and everything seemed normal. They didn't see any differences.
Is that me? Sorry.
Gone.
I don't know.
And the moon tree started talking.
I, for one, welcome our spontaneously speaking MacBook overlords.
Right after I said information is good, and somehow they knew.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's on our side.
I targeted you, Al.
All right. So no one was really paying attention. It looks like they grew. You're like, sapling. It looks the same as the others. Okay. So
right.
What about now?
So there's a NASA astronomer, David Williams, who became curious about these trees. And in 1996, he started tracking what had happened to them. At the time, they only had a record of about 22 of the trees. And so for 15 years, he's had a website where he's tracked the trees and people can report if they find one, because they put them in these little wooden gates with a plaque on the front. And people have been discovering them. And now there's about 80 of them that have been found.
Wow.
And so you can go check out the website. It's kind of neat. But what you can do now is order your own half moon tree.
so you can get a copy of it?
Exactly. So now when those trees drop seeds, you can order the seeds.
And out of curiosity, any difference between this and a seed that didn't go into space?
Not that anyone can tell.
All right.
Speaking, you know what? I have a little space
yeah, go ahead.
Thing. There was a massive solar flare February 16th.
I heard about this.
Yeah, just huge, huge flare. It was detected by NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory, the SDO.
And we're actually, that's actually signaling the end of a very quiet period in the sun, I believe.
Yeah. And there's a video, I mean, I'll post the video on our links as well, because I have the...
It's a cool video.
It's, you know, I mean, it's like...
It's one of those things where I love the images that show a solar flare, and then they superimpose an Earth-sized planet next to it, and you go, oh.
It's like bigger. They said there's going to be some sort of potential interference with electrical power grids.
Right.
And so. This is what happens when everyone forgets to send a Valentine.
Yeah, this was, nice. I think it was something that was discovered by a Japanese researcher. It was a couple of large coronal holes in the sun. And it was, there, I think it was February 1st is when they first started actually turning towards us. And that's what this is part of.
This is what season. We won't get into the details of that, the science behind that today. Because, of course, we could do that. But it would take us a deep hole into the sun. thanks for the moon tree update. I kind of want a moon tree.
Yeah.
Though it's pretty kitschy. Miles, how's it going?
Bad news for confidential data in the future. Solid-state devices, a common speed improvement over spinning rust, also known as hard drives. It turns out it's much harder to...
Spinning rust, that's really great. Oxidized plates, I get it. Yeah. Nice.
It's much harder to remove the data after you're done with it. Like, for example, it's common for people to talk about with regard to security. After you're done with a hard drive, if you're going to donate it or give it to someone else or sell it, that you put it through something that will overwrite with random data six times,
right? Basically totally obliterating the history.
Right, so that there's no possible way someone could get that data, which
there's
would
no
be important.
Feasible way.
Yeah, for many of us, we may not have data that we're that
right.
safe, cared that much about, but the most common place for these hard drives to go into the open market would be from businesses.
Right.
You have a fire sale, like after a business closes and stuff like that. And that has HR data. It has
possible credit card data.
Yeah, it has IP. Sure. It has, you know, stuff like that.
Social security number is the whole deal.
Right. And
so, like, if I was a large corporation, I'm about to upgrade my systems. I'm going to sell my hard drives. I want to make some money on those hard drives. They're still probably valid, but I'm going to make bit better gear. So instead of destroying the hard drives, I'm going to try to sell them. So I rewrite 100 times on each hard drive random data, and then I'm pretty safe to say that no one can get access to that content.
Right. Okay. Solid state drives, different technology. All those utilities that were made for spinning rust to get rid of all the information just don't work as well. You have wear leveling. The idea being that solid state devices only allow a certain amount of writes before it starts to degrade,
mm-hmm.
and so the drive
in the 10,000 area,
right? Mm-hmm. The drive, any particular sector,
yeah. Right.
The drive will. Transparently to the operating system in most cases, although there's some wiggle room there, will, even though you're trying to overwrite the same file, it'll actually give you a whole different sector and
I see what you're saying. So
new.
So the drive itself knows that every location can only be recorded 10,000 times. So what it does is it goes, well, let's just evenly distribute my read and writes across the drive. So if something's been written 100 times, if some other sector hasn't been, then I'll start writing that stuff to the other sector.
Right.
So you're not that there's really sectors, I don't think, but theoretical sectors anyway. So since that drive is so smart, erasing the actual data becomes difficult.
Yes.
You have to bypass that.
Also, erases on a solid-state device by default are merely actually, this is true of hard drives, too.
Yeah,
you just say delete it. All it's doing is deleting the pointer to it.
Right.
It isn't until you go back and try to overwrite that sector, and that's where it gets difficult. So a team at UC San Diego were finding that if you had a gigabyte of data, even when they really tried to scrub that data clean, they still got 10 megabytes back that was unaltered.
Still okay.
That's after they knew what they were looking for, after they really tried, there was still data there.
Right. So couldn't the hard drive manufacturers just produce a kill my data bit and thereby just, you know, flashing all the RAM with random data? You'd think that the drive could do that pretty easily.
And it would cost more.
I can do it for 10 cents.
Does it blend?
A hard drive and a hammer.
Well, I mean, yeah. If you want to destroy the device, sure. And people do that with hard drives. They put it into it. If you ever see videos on YouTube of a hard drive shredder, they're really amazing. Mm-hmm. These big metal just teeth. Just
right.
I think see, what I do is I just give it to my nephew, and he just takes it apart and then breaks the disc.
Yeah, my office mate takes him out to the desert and shoots him.
Yeah. Data security, redneck style.
Well, no, that just means that you have a hole in the platter. It doesn't mean the rest of the stuff wouldn't be.
He shoots them many times.
But the idea is that if you have sensitive data, you might want to actually stay with the hard drive technology for now until that gets worked out.
Or understand that you don't have you can't recycle or reuse these things.
Yes, yeah. Or be sending it to a shredder.
It's such an easy technical problem. Like, it'd be so easy to erase that data if you had access to the actual firmware of the system. It's not. It's a giant grid of small charges. You just reset all the charges. Like, it shouldn't be a big deal.
No, except there's a residual because of just the way it
retains. Right, so you just have the disk do it 40 times randomly. Well,
exactly. And that's what we do in hard drives.
Yeah, but in a hard drive, you actually say, hey, drive, do this. What I'm talking about is on the system that controls the matrices.
Right.
It should be able to do this.
That would be a fun virus going around, that all these solid-state drives have these firmwares that are usually upgradable firmware. That
boom.
Yeah.
I mean, we had an email recently about like how to clear out your hard drive, and that was a regular hard drive, but now in a lot of computers, they're just being shipped with solid-state drives. I know a lot of Apple's been pushing that as an upgrade for a lot of their systems.
Well, another thing is, like, in erasing hard drives, there's also the cache in the drive, right? The drive actually has some cache, and sometimes that doesn't get erased because, of course, that cache is set when you read it, things like that. Anyway, let's move on. I believe, it seems like Al's turn, but we just handled something with Al's. But go ahead, Al. What's going on with eyeglassware?
Oh, this is a really cool. These are chargeable eyeglasses, and what they use is a liquid crystal technology that has a coating over the eyeglass. Now, the eyeglasses, you put them in a little charger, and when you want to use your magnifying, your bifocal activity, you have these glasses on. They're your prescription. You touch the side, and then instantly the lenses, the electrical charge changes the molecules so that the liquid crystal turns it into a magnifying thing. It's a really the glasses they don't look like this horrible like radio glasses you used to have.
They look like normal glasses.
They look almost kind of like Miles glasses he's wearing right now. But
in other words, kind of hipster nerdy.
Yeah, they're not ugly, and they're normal looking glasses.
Nice to meet you.
But you're able to turn this ability, and they even have an accelerometer in the sides that when you look down, it turns. You can set it so that when you look down, it magnifies it. Now these are people over 40. Their eyes are in the baby boomer and all these people. Now these are kind of pricey. They're supposed to be coming out next spring, I believe. This is from New York Times. We're looking like $1,000 for
sure,
or more. But around that area. But they look like a pretty cool thing. I think glasses technology, if you're going to be wearing glasses, this is the way to go.
The question I have is, can they just add magnification whenever you want? Like, you can push a button and get really good magnification so you can start looking at slides. And, does it have, built-in superhero powers?
Oh, well, that does have the built. I mean, you are able to adjust that. So there, the example they have is, you go play golf, and then you hit the golf ball, and then you look down and touch your glasses to be able to read the scorecard.
That's awesome.
It's very awesome. Neat. Yeah. Very neat cool. gadget.
They need to make it so that, it's picks up on some sort of muscular thing, so you just kind of concentrate and you can zoom in.
Well, just have it like an IR sensor that does distance finding wherever your glasses are doing. It focuses to that point.
The glasses are like they've got microchips in them. So I mean, this is just the beginning.
Hey, you got me with you had me with microchips. Alex, what's up in the fertility world?
Fertility world. All right. Well, some research has been done to kind of study how traveling into space will, how humans can travel into space and what the complications and the challenges will be. Well, one of which is if we have to do long-term missions, we can't just send people out and come back when we're talking about a 20-year mission. So that, you know, we have to think about that they're actually going to have children. They're actually mm-hmm. have generations that are born in space. Well, there's some issues with that because of radiation.
That generations in space, 64% of sci-fi right there.
Yeah.
Go
well,
on.
Apparently, I mean, because of, we don't have a great ability to shield some of the radioactive particles, the influence and the mutation that this or the effect that this radiation can have on the fetus, particularly during a period during its development where the eggs in a female fetus are kind of or the reproductive parts of the system basically are not evolving, but developing.
They're very fragile. I mean, what the basic idea, of course, is that like, if you and I lose a cell or have a cell that goes aberrant because of a radiation, most likely our body will compensate for it, right? It will probably not be very functional, and the other cells around it will grow and it won't reproduce fine or duplicate itself fine. No big deal. But when you're talking about a fetus and you're talking about, you know, maybe 5,000 cells, you lose one of those cells and you could actually have a real serious
right.
side
or
effect.
Even when it's just three or four or five
very
cells,
small cell.
When,
yeah,
when those eventually, because of the replication,
right.
End it's up being sensitive. The whole
I mean, these are the reasons why, you know, pregnant women, mostly, really should be restrictive on what's the environment's really sensitive. They're really sensitive mm-hmm. to environmental issues.
Yep.
So what you're saying is, fetus in space, not so good.
Not so good. So it creates a challenge. I mean, either we have
how
to come
do we
up with
reproduce?
Better shielding.
Yeah.
Or, and, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize when you're on the space station, they're getting hit with a lot of radiation.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still close enough to our magnetic shield that they're getting protected somewhat, but not all of it.
So that's only one problem. Lindsay, one other problem? We're running out of time on the show, but one other problem with space?
Basically, you can't take certain plastics and rubber into space. But luckily, because if it freezes, because it'll break if it's frozen and it can't withstand heat because it will melt. But some Japanese scientists came up with a carbon nanotube-based rubber that can withstand extreme temperatures up to like 1,000 degrees centigrade.
Cool.
Which they can get close to the sun, or they could even go into the icy Jupiter's largest moons if they had a spacecraft that was covered in this stuff, supposedly.
So wait, you'd use it to cover your spacecraft, like rubber spacecraft?
This is all theory, but yes, you could maybe make a suit
so
out of it.
So we have super rubber at high temperature and shark skin. Very
exactly.
cool. Lindsay's got skins today. We are almost out of time on Geek Speak, but I do want to make sure that we get to the geek bit, so I'm going to go ahead and do some of this stuff. Mentioning that Geek Speak is registered service mark for online tonight let's try that again. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, the Geeks Today, Lindsay, Alex, Miles, and Al has a crazy USB of the week.
Yeah, this was sent in by a listener, and right off the top of my head, I can't remember who it was, but it's called the Beanzawave. It's the world's smallest microwave. This thing is 725 watts, and you plug it into... most of them are 725 watts.
Right, yeah.
You plug it into a USB. It's 7.4 inches tall by 6.2 inches wide. And you plug it in next to a USB port, and you can heat up mid-afternoon snacks. It's a very odd thing. I don't know that I'd want a little tiny microwave next to my computer.
Speaking
running.
Of radiation.
Yeah. I mean, and it's very, it's got plastic on the outside, and, you know, it's...
USB microwave.
Yes, it's a USB microwave, and it's being developed in conjunction with Heinz. So, very odd.
Uh-oh. I can see hot dogs up next to the keyboard mm-hmm. big time.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Al. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, everything we talked about today is at geekspeak.org. If